Accession number 30143, Reel 6.
It was quite clever. For a simple thing, it was, had good psychological operations. It was smart. And those burned for many weeks. So the city was shrouded in this black smoke for many weeks. I went and visited the horse artillery, who are based at the airport then, on the outskirts of Basra. They've been firing artillery fire support for various attacks that have been going in. I think obviously the British were holding back. Basra has taken quite a long time to go, and obviously the Americans had pushed right up. I was completely unaware of what was going on at this point. I was sort of on my own. I was out of the information loop. I forgot to say, by pure coincidence, I think I drove up to the airport. The first person I met on the gate, I said, "Oh, I'm looking for the Royal Horse Artillery." And the sentry on duty, I said, "I'm looking for the first one RHA. That's how I said it. And he goes, "Oh, yeah, it's us." No, so the first British troops I've met happened to be from the unit who wanted me. And I go, "Oh, you wouldn't know Lieutenant Budd?" He goes, "Yeah, he's the boss. I'll go and get him." And that. I was sort of lost for words. And he, when I said, "Oh, I'm Matthew Cook, the Times War Artist," he goes, "Oh, God, where have you been? So you got all my messages?" And I go, "No, I've literally come in and you're the first person I've bumped into." It just, the chances of that happening, the second British soldier happened to be the one who had been trying to get me. Very weird, very weird.
Why were they trying to get you?
They wanted a record of their operations in Iraq. Post-conflict, I did them five drawings to cover various sort of elements, their echelon, the guns firing from Basra Airport, and then patrolling in Basra sort of after it had been taken. So that was great, that I could stay away from the media. I think I wasn't aware of the media, partly because they wanted me to be there, so they looked after me. They trusted me. I said I was in the TA, and the barriers came down. They put me in a room with their anti-tank weapons and all their 5.56 ammunition, which I was quite impressed. That takes some trust to put an unknown stranger in with all your weapons. They wouldn't even let the translators near the ammunition and stuff. So then I knew I'd sort of been accepted, and once they got used to me, they sort of didn't notice me anymore, so I'd go out on patrols. I think a day or two later, Basra was taken, and they pushed into the palace. And I went in with them. The media quickly took over one building again. I completely blanked it, and I stayed with the luxury of the Royal Horse Artillery. Things were very basic, and the palace sounds grand.
Yes, what was it like exactly?
It's completely walled building. Walled building. It's. I don't even know the 2 or 3 square kilometres of walled and turreted ground, and probably 5 or 6 very grand buildings. So it's not a palace, it's a palace complex with a sort of moat and bridges and rather tacky, ornate, gardeny bit. And the rumour was that Saddam had cleared all the date palms for kilometres. It's right on the Shatal waterway, and he cleaned the date palms on the far bank as well, because he was worried about, it was fairly hotly fought over in the Iran-Iraq war, but he was worried about snipers or ambushes, so he wanted to see anyone who comes. So, and local Iraqis weren't allowed anywhere near it, so as soon as it fell, it got looted, and even when we got there a couple of days later, people were just wandering down the road just saying, "We've never been able to walk down here and just have a look at it." So it's very strange. I think Royal Marines had initially taken the palace, and they crapped in the toilets, and there was no water, so everything stank, full of flies. It was horrible. Maybe I shouldn't mention units there. No furniture, everything had been looted from the marble flooring was still there, but from light switches to the lights they weren't valuable. They were often made out of gold-plated plastic. You know, it was all tacky stuff, but the Iraqis had looted it. They saw it as theirs.
Did you see the looters yourself, or draw?
Not there, but later on in Baghdad, I came across them. Another point. Yes, in other parts of Basra, they're still looting. So it's it's very strange, anarchic phase, where you had the troops who had been fighting, literally one day stop fighting. Now you're peace support, which is completely different rules of engagement. You could only fire when you're fired upon. Or you could only fire if you thought you were preserving a life. So from war fighting, literally the previous day, to peace support, very strange. Normally, I think they try and get a new tranche of troops to take over that role, because you know, these guys have got a mindset. I've seen guys killed, we've come under fire for the last how many weeks, so it possibly could have helped in causing some of those abuses, but I think those abuses were very minimal. I can say, hand on heart, I never saw anything bad treatment either way, really. Well, yes, we're still getting shot at, but I never met any of those guys. But the British were hiring Iraqis to work as translators. In those early days, they weren't going around disguised with shamars over them. They're being paid, the British Army were paying them a sultry $5 a day, I think, $5. And then word spread round that the BBC was paying them something like $50 a day. And the BBC, in their wisdom, they just had an overseas rate for translators, so this is what the guys did. And it completely threw the economy of Basra. Employment was sort of non-existent, and the BBC probably had 10 or 15 translators who were flooding the market with these thousands of dollars they were earning, and it completely knocked, such a small thing, but it knocked the balance of the whole town out. Quite interesting, until I think someone picked up on it and they dropped their pay down to $10 a day or something, so it went back into balance. But it's a weird, quirky story that knocked out the economy. Yes, then stayed with them in the palace for a good, I'd say probably a week. I think the fighting was still going up in Baghdad. The palace would come under machine gun fire and fire from across the river. You could hear the rounds that crack and thump. Again, this is another lesson learnt from the hostile environment. You hear the cracks first and then the thump. And if someone hadn't told me, it wouldn't dawn on you that was sort of incoming rounds. It's another weird thing. In fact, there was someone who used to fire off 20 or 30 rounds from across the Chateau Arab at the palace, and he'd do it almost lunchtime every day, almost at the same time. He'd hear but steady shots, so he was obviously aiming at something, and no one bothered really, he just carried on. Very strange. Rumours were rife. I wasn't privy to all the sort of intelligence briefs, but I know one night there was supposed to be a group of about 50 former soldiers, Iraqi soldiers, who were going to attack the palace. They knew that defences hadn't really been put in and that the British had only just taken it over. And that was quite alarming, that the cooks, the mechanics, everyone was manning positions. So obviously people were scared. Thankfully nothing happened, but there was a constant rattle of gunfire from in town. The SAS were operating from there, and the CIA, they're wearing, you can often see them, just long beards and very tanned, carrying sort of Kurtz machine guns, just all the non-issue military equipment. Could tell who they were. At this point, the horse artillery started doing foot patrols in town, which they had never really trained for, so it was quite interesting. They did very well. I went with them, was obviously drawing, so to me this was a time in my life. I was on my own, everything had just clicked into place. Thankfully, I did buy loads of cigarettes when I was in Kuwait or even in the airport, so I could trade those for all the military runs on diesel fuel, but my vehicle was on unleaded, which I wasn't going to find in Baghdad, but I hadn't thought that through. But thankfully for the military, all their generators run on normal petrol, so for a few cigarettes and a few favours, a couple of quick scribbles, they would fill up my jerry cans. So at least I knew when I started to head up to Baghdad and things, I'd have full jerry cans. And my fear was running out of fuel. Shit, where do you get it from? It's obviously, this is the looting, rioting, anarchic bit. I had a great time with the horse artillery. They got me on some river patrols with the engineers, so we searched some of the Shat al-Arab was still full of wrecked shipping from the Iran-Iraq war, some huge sort of container ships and things of arsenes poking out of the water. It looked amazing. I still have got so many drawings yet to do. It's going to be a lifetime. The subject matter, it was just unbelievable. And it was so different from Kuwait, where it's all, the car is everything. Everything is motorways and flyovers and cars and glass hotels. Petrol was 6p a litre. And, suddenly in Iraq, it was dirt roads, potholes, everything was made out of sort of adobe bricks, moulded and dried in the sun. And the main cities weren't biblical, but as soon as you got out towards the banks of the Euphrates, it looked biblical. So it was a delight to draw. And unfortunately, I was usually with the army, so I couldn't sort of wander off down back streets. But we were mobbed by children and just curious people to come out. And at the time, everyone was going, down to Saddam, and thank you for George Bush, people coming up and shaking your hands, and so it was very euphoric at the time. Still occasional mortars and rockets, and I had some close scrapes. A military Land Rover got hit by an RPG an hour before I drove down the road, and you never know how close you are to these things. So it was very dangerous still, but I felt safe being with the army. So
still had the same armour on, did you?
Yes.
Which wasn't fully protected.
Yes. And my blue Times issue helmet, which I didn't wear that often. As soon as the war fighting stopped, the British armies decided to wear their floppy hats, which was a sort of less aggressive pose. Although being an occupying army, they didn't want to seem sort of too confrontational. So I could just put my, I think I did buy a floppy hat of some sort. I would go out with on foot patrols. I'd carry my day sack, my camera, my body armour, obviously, my ID cards, which went everywhere with me, my press card, and always some water. I felt quite happy. Again, I was sleeping where the ammunition was, so I felt quite happy leaving money and stuff there. I just didn't feel anything would be stolen. Obviously leave my vehicle there with its scanner and laptop, so I was quite relaxed about all that. They supplied me with some 24-hour ration packs, so I was back to familiar army food. So things were looking up. It was all quite exciting.
How about the technology now with sending your pictures?
Yes, this is where I had to learn. This is where the most valuable piece of paper I had was this A4 sheet, both sides scribbled with press Apple hash to do this, literally step by step of how to save the images. So there was no power, obviously, in the palace, no water, there was no lighting. Right, now at the palace,
we were talking about sending your pictures off.
Yes, at the palace there was no power, no water, so this was literally where I had this is where I had to learn how to plug everything into the cigarette lighter of the car. Now, obviously, I had to conserve fuel, but I'd have to run the engine to keep the battery going, and the battery would run low if everything was plugged into the cigarette lighter. So it was a bit of a vicious circle. Even if I wasn't driving, I'd still be using up petrol. And the palace is next to quite a swampy area, so it was normally early evening to dusk where I'd start drawing, and I'd use the car front seat just because I had everything in the car, so and I knew I wouldn't be disturbed, so I'd sit in the car. The mosquitoes would come out at dusk, so I'd often have to have the windows up. The sweat would be dripping off me. Obviously, that's normally when I'd work on the colour drawings. I'd have my inks and I'd start working on those black and white drawings I'd have. Once the drawings are done, I would keep them in the sketchbook. I wouldn't cut them out, but I could lay the sketchbook onto the scanner, which is in the back seat of the car. I tried to make that as level as I could, propped up on some ration packs. The scanner was plugged into the cigarette lighter as well, and plugged into my laptop, which also had a battery life, so I had to try and preserve that battery as well. So I would scan the drawing and save it as a file onto my laptop, which I do every day now, but at the time it was gulp, how do you do this? So I literally had my idiot-proof list of press this, go to that. And obviously it's for the papers, you had to be very accurate. Place names, I didn't always know how to spell. At the time, Basra was spelt about 5 different ways. Some people called it Al Basra. Different papers spelt it different ways. So it's now, in hindsight, everyone's come to the same thing, but at the time it was still a bit chaotic. So I'm trying to find out what name the suburb was, get the regiment right. So quite a lot of work just going into getting your facts straight. It's a bit of journalism, I suppose. So I had to get it right. So once the drawings were saved onto my laptop as a folder, I could then disconnect the scanner. I would then plug in the satellite phone also into the cigarette lighter. I managed to find, I never knew these existed, there's a cigarette lighter fixture that has all sorts of plug sockets to it, so you're not committed just to plugging one thing on, but it does drain your car battery, so it's all batteries and trying to keep it going. So. But it was a good place to learn, at least I was relatively safe, and I'm just going to turn my phone off. Yes, as I said, I had a fixture that went into the cigarette, like a multi-socket plug, really. So I could plug several things in. It did get very hot in itself, so I didn't want to overload it. The satellite phone took about 20 minutes. That had to sit on the roof. It opened up into a dish, and it's got a compass on it, so you had to find out which region of the Earth satellites you were going to use and point it in that direction. So there's a manual going with your Southeast Asia, Middle East, and then it would give you a number of degrees to point the scanner in. It's got a radiation hazard, so you don't want to sit in front of it. So definitely made sure that was on the roof and I wasn't in front of it once it was on. Could take up to 20 minutes to actually make a fix on some satellites. It had a sort of meter reading once you got a good signal. So that was connected to my laptop, and once I had a good signal on the satellite phone, I was safe to send the drawings. And to be honest, I can't remember how I did that now, but it was the whole process took about between an hour and 45 minutes. That was quite a palaver, but it became a daily routine. I got a bit better at it, but at the first few I'd just do everything rather aimly, just making sure it worked. And that was probably my biggest fear, was just to make sure these drawings were getting back. By now my confidence had grown that, before the conflict I was worried that everything was going to be camouflaged and sand coloured against sand, so I was just worried these make good drawings. And it was quite tricky. Aircraft were just a pale grey, which was quite tricky to draw or make look powerful. So that was a worry of mine. But now I was sort of fully into it, and out on the streets in Basra, so a sky full of black smoke. It was suddenly the images were coming through now, and I was on a high. completely separate from the media, so it's just me and the army. Sort of, you know, I don't have any fears about the army. At least I understood how they worked, and they trusted me enough. I sit in some of the orders groups now, and that the horse artillery then sort of introduced me to the Irish Guards and some of the other units. The Black Watch who were in Basra, so I almost got passed around some of the other units around Basra, which was great. So they were all patrolling different parts of the city, and they were all stationed in different parts of the city. The Black Watch were in an old gymnasium somewhere out in the middle of town, and they were patrolling the old souks in the old town, which now is completely out of bounds. It was thought that that's where all the house-to-house fighting would happen, but it's still completely out of bounds, the British troops. So it's,
and you would have gone into this?
Yes. Oh, it was fascinating. And locals offered us tea. We'd sort of sit hunched down. I'd always accept the tea. I heard it was very impolite to say no, so a lot of the troops would just get off cheers, but I'd always make a point of, yeah, sipping it, and I learned to say Salaamu Alaikum, and learned a few of the customs. So it's,
yes, it's interesting. One forgets these more peaceful civilian times.
Yes, when, yes.
Yes.
It was anarchy. Yes, but it was a weird time. There was lots of shooting going on. At night time, I then moved off to the Ba'ath Party headquarters, or the former Ba'ath Party headquarters. Can't remember who was there. All sorts of units were squashed into there. And now these buildings, obviously being part of the Ba'ath Party, had been targeted by the Air Force, and three JDAM bombs were still unexploded in it. So it was quite a big building complex, but walled again, which is why the British Army took them over, because there was some way of protecting them. So one of these huge buildings had imploded and collapsed on itself, and the others, another one had a hole. You could go up onto the sort of 14th floor and look at this hole go all the way through the building where one of the JDAMs had gone, and it was still there unexploded. And obviously if this was peacetime, there'd be a sort of kilometre safety zone around it, but because it was war there. And another one on the way to the cookhouse, there's a big hole in the pavement, and that was another JDAM somewhere buried down there. And they couldn't tell whether it was a British or Americans, and no one knew quite what sort of fuse it had, whether it was trouble, or all they did was put a bit of tape round and just carry on as normal. So yeah, it was strange times. There was quite civilised. The building was full of bullet holes. I was sleeping up on the second or third floor. Troops were spread throughout this building, you know, washing, hanging on the balconies, and I had a washing line inside. I just had to sweep the glass and dust into one corner. I was sleeping on a door that had been blown off, so I lay that down on the ground to keep out of the dust. And I'd sleep on my body armour, and I'd use my sheet that I'd stolen just to keep the mosquitoes off, and I'd just sweat all night. So yes, it was a building, but it's still quite unpleasant, and obviously no furniture or anything. But I had a balcony, so I could go out there in the morning and shave and to see what's happening. At night time, I used to go up on the roof and set up the satellite phone on the roof. So I'd still use my vehicle to do the drawings, but you get a far better signal on the roof. And there was a mosque nearby which had some rather tinny call to prayer. I think I was in the Ba'ath Party headquarters 3 or 4 nights. Just had a great time there. It was just, the army was quite relaxed because it was still war fighting. It, you know, once it becomes peace support, they get a bit more anal and stuff. I think when I left Basra Palace, they were just starting to paint the rocks around the road white, and it was, yeah, it's turning a bit to making guard rooms, and the RSM was strutting around. It was time to leave, so it was nice to go to the Ba'ath Party where it was still a bit anarchic and everything was chaos. And my routine, on my hexamine stove, I'd brew my cup of coffee, traipse all the satellite phone and cables up to the roof, Thankfully the satellite phone has got its own battery, so I could charge it on the car. And listening to the call of prayer, I'd scan the drawings and send them off back to London. And at night time you'd see all the firefights in town and all the tracer fire. And true, you wouldn't silhouette yourself in daytime off the top of the buildings, because everyone had weapons and who knows what grudge, or it could be shot for no apparent reason. So some of the tracer would go over my head, others was just fired straight up into the air as celebratory. But it was just exciting, an exciting spell. And for my last couple of days I decided to get away from the army a bit. Yeah, we did some amazing patrols in town, just fascinating bits of town. So I hadn't really been alone with the Iraqis at this stage. It was always very much I was one of the army, especially with my camouflage body armour, and I often went out sometimes with just a green t-shirt. And if I went out in the warrior, you know, one of the fighting vehicles, they'd often give me a helmet. So all they could see of me in the turret was my body armour, green t-shirt and a helmet. So I looked like a soldier to anyone else. The Black Watch were very good. They took me round and showed me to a lot of the areas where the fighting had happened. So I had my sort of hot battlefield tour. And I managed to drive one of the horse artillery guys. They never get to see the damage of their fire missions. So I drove him round Basra to the technical college, which they were shelling when I was at the airport, you know, and showed him the damage that their 155mm shells did. He was fascinated, absolutely fascinated. He was rattling away photos. Because suddenly he realised how the army, as I would find out when I got mobilised, you're very limited. You're never going to be away from your team. You're never going to meet the locals, really. You can't just sort of disappear off. Suddenly, that's when it dawned on me, I had this freedom. I really could wander anywhere. I was under no constraints. I had no brief from the Times of, oh, you must go here, you must go there. I was on my own.
End of reel 5 and 6.